Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Bill Fagley about his new book, The Nightcrawler King, Memoirs of an Art Curator. We'll also hear from Maurice Carlos Ruffin and Bernice McFadden, who are two of the contributors to the new anthology, 400 Souls, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019. William Fagley is curator emeritus at the New Orleans Museum of Art, where he served for 50 years as curator of African art, contemporary art, and self-taught art, as well as serving as assistant director for more than 20 years. Over the course of his career, he organized more than 90 exhibitions. Today, we're talking about his new book, The Nightcrawler King, Memoirs of an Art Museum Curator. Bill Fagley, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, and it's good to be back.
Now, one of the things that makes this book so much fun is that it's a story of people. And one of my favorite chapters, of course, is Ladies of My Life, which gives us such great portraits of Edith Rosenwald Stern, Muriel Boltman Francis, and Sonny Norman. Oh, and of course, Mickey Easterling, such amazing characters. So talk about some of the great women art patrons that you've known over the years.
Well, those people, and also Francoise Richardson, Leah Chase. Let me just say that this is one of the, I think, lagniappes of being a curator at a major art museum, is that you have access to these people because they are supporting the museum, or you wish they were supporting the museum. And so you become friendly with them, and I have been known as a walker, which means that the single man who accompanies well-to-do women, usually, to other events. And so in that capacity, I got to know them quite well, and I'm sharing those experiences in this book.
And then, of course, you have a chapter on being an artist groupie, which I loved. And it's just so much fun. I mean, Linda Binglis is somebody who was very important to you and important to the creation of this book as well, right?
Yes, indeed. She and I have been friends for, well, since the mid-70s. And we still chat on the phone. And one of the things that she did when the book was being published, all the 40 illustrations were going to be in black and white. And if they were to be in color, it would cost something extra. And when I told Linda this, she came up and said, "How much?" And I told her, and she sent the money to the publisher. And so, courtesy of Linda Binglis, all of the 40 illustrations in the book are in color.
Oh, now that's a friend.
Yes, indeed.
You also made some memorable treks. I mean, one of them was, to meet George O'Keefe at Ghost Ranch.
Yes, it was very memorable.
I met her in Abiquiu in 1990 and spent an afternoon with her. I remember walking out of that house and she kissed me goodbye on my cheek, and I thought, I will never wash my face again. I mean, it's like, my life is all downhill now. I mean, there's something so magical about her in that landscape, don't you think? Seeing her where she works?
Absolutely. It was a rare time. And I mean, you felt like you were doing something. It was special. It was, you just felt invigorated. And she was such a lovely, gracious, very quiet, demure person, but very inquisitive. When I said I was the curator at the New Orleans Museum of Art, she says, "Oh, I was in New Orleans." And I said, she said it was in 1919. And I said, "Oh, well, what do you remember?" She said, "Well, what I remember is the all the clothes hanging on the lines between houses." and she expressed a desire to want to come back and go into the swamp. And I said, "Well, I can arrange that." And it never happened, unfortunately. But
well, that would have made a great chapter. I mean,
yeah.
And since, of course, we mentioned Andy Warhol, talk a little bit about spending time with him.
Well, again, that was special. He came with his entourage, which he always had his people around him. And they were a colorful group of people. He loved New Orleans. And I think New Orleans had an appeal to him because of who we are and our particular culture. So he was fascinated by the city, and his one request was to meet the photographer Clarence John Laughlin, who lived in the Upper Pentalba Apartments in the attic. And, you know, Clarence John is a iconic figure in the history of American photography, and so I thought, goodness, wouldn't this be an experience?
Yeah.
Having two icons meet, and I did it. Anyway, it's a funny story of what happened, because we did do it, and that was very special to me.
And you've known all the New Orleans artists. I mean, you're a good friend of Dawn Didot, and she gave you the title for this book, didn't she?
Yes, she did. You know, we've been friends for, well, I guess 50 years. I don't know. And so I told her I was writing my memoirs. By the way, these memoirs were not written overnight. They were written over a period of about 35 years. I wrote sections when they were fresh in my mind, when it just had happened. And therefore, the truthfulness and the detail is pretty specific, and because I did it at that time. It's not a recreation of something that happened 30 years ago.
Well, when you read it, it feels very immediate. It feels like it's happening, and it's very alive. Well,
at that time, it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the time I wrote it, yes. Anyway, I was telling Dawn about my memoirs that I was preparing, and I told her about the incident in my childhood when I became the Nightcrawler King of Dearborn County, Indiana. And she said, "That's the title of your book." And I said, "Yes, it is."
Thank you. So you had a Nightcrawler stand, and everyone came to buy your Nightcrawlers for fishing.
They were very special Nightcrawlers, I have to say. My father was a fisherman, and he went with some of his friends to Canada one year to fish. And Canada, for some reason, is noted for having excellent Nightcrawlers. And so my dad brought them back and planted them in our backyard of our house. And they really were special. They were bigger and fatter and longer than regular Nightcrawlers. So that's the reason I got that distinction, because mine were better than anybody else.
you're just joining us, I'm talking with Bill Fakely about his new book, The Nightcrawler King, Memoirs of an Art Curator. Now, one of the most interesting chapters to me, and I think to a lot of readers, will be the chapter about August 2005. And we all know what that means, Katrina, of course. So talk a little bit about your experience at NOMA then. Everybody had to pitch in and do everything at the museum then, it seemed.
Well, when Katrina hit, I was not in town. I was in Houston. But I did come back soon after the hurricane and got special permission, thanks to Jackie Sullivan, for the state police, the Louisiana State Police, to enter the city and the National Guard. And she and I would come in daily into the then flooded city, but we couldn't get to the museum. But the museum's insurance company, they approached us when this happened, which is unusual, and said, how can we help? Anyway, they did help in a very substantial way. And Jackie and I would drive in to the suburbs, and we'd meet in the Elmwood shopping center parking lot, because that's where the insurance company had hired some retired New York City policemen and a helicopter. And with that, we would fly in over the flooded city to the museum, where the New York City policemen were also standing guard at the museum for 24/7 because of the value of the collection. So, yes, it was a disturbing time. And not just for me, but everybody. Everybody has a Katrina story, and that's part of mine.
I think that's one of the things that brings us together as a city now, that choice to be here and stay here and do the hard work, you know?
Yes.
Now, one of the things you write that's so charming and dear, it's you write, New Orleans was to be my Oz. And you came here after you'd grown up in Indiana. You had this bucolic small town upbringing, really, and this loving family. And then you went to get a job in Florida that didn't materialize. And then you just took a turn and came to New Orleans with all your stuff. I mean, don't you just marvel sometimes at the arc of your own life now that you look at it and you've got it all there before you in a book?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also, I have to say that fortune was with me all the way. I was a chemistry major in college, and then I took an organic chemistry course in let's just say that didn't work out. And so I went next door to the art department and told them that I wanted to be an art museum curator and study art history. And at that point, I had never been to an art museum, and I didn't know what they did in an art museum. But I knew that's what I wanted. And then lo and behold, circumstances came about where one of the courses I was taking in art history, a high Renaissance course, the professor suddenly disappeared and wasn't there on the appropriate time for the class. And we found out that he had been dismissed by the university very abruptly. And the chairman of the art department was a very well-connected, let's say, art historian and in the art world. Like, he was friendly with Picasso and had lunches with him. And so he brought in this young man who turned out to be the first trained African art historian in the United States to teach African art. And I thought, well, gee, that's different. Mm-hmm. And so I took the course, and I just thought the subject was fascinating, and I really liked the professor. And that's how I became a curator of African art. I have my master's degree in that. And I look back today and realize that if that High Renaissance professor had not been dismissed by Indiana University, I would have never been a curator of African art and probably ever come to New Orleans.
What luck. What great luck for us and for you. We've been talking with Bill Fagley, who's New Orleans Museum of Art Curator Emeritus and author of the new book, The Nightcrawler King. You can hear him talk about his book Thursday, February 18th at 6 in a Zoom conversation with John Bullard, sponsored by the Garden District Bookshop. Go to gardendistrictbookshop.com for more information and the link. Bill, thank you so much.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
It almost goes without saying that any book called 400 Souls, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019, would include Louisiana history and Louisiana writers. This massive book, edited by Ibram X. Kendi, author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, and Keisha N. Blaine, author of How to Set the World on Fire, includes history, fiction, and poetry by 90 writers. The book includes work by 5 writers from Louisiana, poet Jericho Brown, Donna Brazile, novelist Bernice McFadden, and novelist Maurice Carlos Ruffin, as well as poet-journalist Clint Smith. Today, we're talking with Maurice and Bernice about their contributions. Maurice Ruffin, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Oh, it's such a great pleasure to be here. Happy New Year and happy Mardi Gras season to everybody. Be safe out there.
Oh, that too. Now, every contributor to this anthology writes a short piece that represents a particular time period, and your work represents the period 1644 to 49, and it's a short story called Anthony Johnson, Colony of Virginia. So how did this work? Did they assign you a time period? Did you choose it?
They did assign it. It was a good release of my nerves to know what I was going to have to work on. You know, I didn't think of myself. So as a result, I just said, okay, what do I know and what should I learn in order to deal with this? And it was fun to get to the research and to learn about Anthony Johnson, who I was vaguely aware of, and then take the next step to develop a story for him.
So tell us a little bit about him and what made him interesting to you as a subject.
Yeah, well, you know, the amazing thing about it is that I think most of us know enough about the American history of race and racism and slavery in this country. But there was a strange period back in the 1600s before the sort of standards had coalesced, when you had people who were walking around who looked like me, who were African-American, who you might have assumed were slaves, but they were not slaves. And Mr. Johnson, he actually had come directly from the continent of Africa, and he had been in indentured servitude for a period of time, I think about 5 years or 15 years. It's kind of unclear in the record. But once he got free, he was actually given some tools, given some clothes, given a small amount of money to start a new life for himself, which was the standard back then for everybody, you know, regardless of their race. And so he just made a life for himself. He fell in love. He got married. He had children. He got some land, developed it. And he really did some pretty incredible things for that time period.
And what was your point of connection with him? When did you know you had him? Because you breathed such life into him. His voice sounds a little bit like yours, you know, great pride and achievement and pretty determined.
Well, you know, the thing about it that I loved about him, it was also kind of sad to think about, is that it was clear to me based upon his actions and that he developed land, made a lot of money, had a big family. He trusted the American dream that you could actually make it here. Mm-hmm. The law also. But it seems to be that eventually his luck ran out because the system was against him. It seems like the older he got, the more the rules were designed to disenfranchise African Americans in the place that he was living. And so he maintained that trust and that love, and he just kept losing things. He lost land, he lost property, he lost money, and his family disappears from the record, I think maybe a generation after he dies.
So what do you think about being one of 5 Louisiana writers in this book? We're well represented.
I'm very proud. You know, all those writers are people that I know and respect and that I learn from. And I just think that, you know, our state and, of course, the city of New Orleans as well as having this renaissance from African-American writers who are given the opportunity to show what we can do, and I'm just happy to be a part of that.
Well, it was such a pleasure. Like I said, I picked up the book and opened it, and it opened right to your page. So, Maurice, you've got the touch.
Susan, I always enjoy talking to you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Bernice McFadden joins us now. Bernice, your essay, Zora Neale Hurston, represents the time period from 1934 to 39, which is so appropriate because you've been a finalist for the Hurston Wright Legacy Award 4 times.
Yeah.
So what an inspiration she's been to you.
Absolutely. Like I said in my essay, I first discovered her in 1987, the summer of 1987. I was actually pregnant with my daughter at the time. And I read Their Eyes Were Watching God. And I will admit that I struggled in the beginning because I had to wrap my mind around the dialect.
Mm-hmm.
But then it just, after like the first 2 chapters, it just flowed. It just flowed for me. And I was like, oh, I know this language. I've heard this language. My aunts and uncles, they speak this language. So yeah, it was wonderful revisiting that moment.
So you explored linguistic alienation and the importance of African-American vernacular English. So talk a little bit about that bilinguality.
Well, you know, like I said in the essay, again, I was raised in a household where some of my elders, they were very specific about what type of language we should use in and outside of the house in order to be, you know, accepted in the white world. I come from a family that is Southern on my mother's side and Caribbean on my father's side. So I was raised with those two entities, and I absorbed the language, and I enjoyed the language. I loved the melody of the language, the sayings and the phrases that are so colorful and creative. Oftentimes, though, when I would find myself in, say, a corporate situation, I had to code switch and you know, speak the language of my oppressors. And it wasn't always easy. I always felt like I was fumbling through that type of English. But now in middle age, I've decided that whatever comes out of my mouth comes out of my mouth. And you know, it's not that someone who was raised outside of that environment cannot understand me. It's just that they have been indoctrinated to believe that anyone who does not speak the, you know, quote unquote Queen's language or the King's language is inferior intellectually wise. And of course, we know that is absolutely untrue.
Well, one of the things I love about this essay is, well, first of all, it celebrates a remarkable woman who deserves to be better known all the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really important thing to include in this anthology.
Yes, it absolutely was, because she was off the literary radar for 40 years or more until Alice Walker came along and reintroduced her into the world. I think about Zora Neale Hurston quite often because she was such a remarkable human being and writer. It's upsetting to me that she was treated the way she was during her lifetime and virtually forgotten, even buried in an unmarked grave. I'm thrilled, of course, that she has been rediscovered and that people are reading her and falling in love with her work and her words and her politics as well.
We should also shout out the other 3 writers included in this anthology from Louisiana. Jericho Brown of Shreveport, who provides a stirring poem upon arrival about the losses of newly arrived enslaved people. Donna Brazile recreates the life of Richard Allen, born enslaved but who became a Methodist bishop. Clint Smith writes about a slave rebellion in Louisiana in 1811 after a visit to Whitney Plantation. And Louisiana history is everywhere in this book. The Code Noir, the landing of slave ships, the Creoles of Color, the Crescent City White League, Plessy v. Ferguson, and of course, Hurricane Katrina. This is a spectacular chorus of voices, truly a beloved community. Read 400 Souls even if you read it one entry at a time. As a matter of fact, that's the perfect way to read it. Take it in one voice at a time, and then appreciate the grand chorus. On tap in the literary life this week. Ed Tarkington discusses his novel The Fortunate Ones with novelist Wiley Cash, Thursday, February 18th at 6 in a Zoom conversation sponsored by Octavia Books. Go to octaviabooks.com for more information. One Book, One New Orleans presents the first virtual discussion of this year's selection, The Yellow House, a memoir by Sarah Broom. That's Thursday, February 18th at 6:30. Register at onebooknola.org. And Michael Tisserand is the guest for Virtual Happy Hour Friday, February 19th at 5 p.m., sponsored by Garden District Bookshop. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.